This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. This is a talk about the encampments of this spring and a case study in the explosion of religious life that occurred in the fire and heat of liberated zones across the country. However, I want to zoom out a little bit before we do that case study. We are nearly 11 months into a genocide. 186,000 Palestinians are dead, and the IDF is preparing tanks to expand the genocide into the West Bank. In a talk about religion, I would be remiss to mention that the Palestinian Christian community in particular is facing extermination. The stakes are dire, and our movements haven't won. And I imagine many of us have struggled to hold on to hope. There are many talks this weekend about Palestine and about how to fight and win. I encourage you to attend those. I encourage you to think about what it would mean for us to secure an arms embargo, to stop a genocide, to destroy a settler state, and to live in a world with a free fucking Palestine. I encourage you to think seriously about what you can give of yourself and your life to freedom. This is a talk about the encampments. This is a talk about students and community members who faced off against the cops for freedom, taking buildings and throwing water canisters, who took and continue to take at much personal cost arrests and sanctions for Palestinian liberation. As did protesters last week in this city during the DNC. Genocidaires came to town and people here did their best to say absolutely fucking not, a change in figurehead is not enough. While Mayor Brandon Johnson celebrated excellent policing, the reality is that dozens of our comrades were brutalized and arrested by CPD and are facing serious consequences for their desire for a free Palestine. So here in Chicago and on every campus and in every city, drop the charges. Drop the charges and end the genocide and fuck this genocidal war machine we call a country. And with that, bismillah. I went to Ohio State University for undergrad. Ohio State did not have an encampment this spring. The action at which they set to launch an encampment was broken violently by the cops. The cops were there the whole time. They set up before the protesters even did. But they waited until large swaths of the crowd had stood for prayer. They were standing shoulder to shoulder, large amounts of the community, not paying attention to what was going on around them, but taking a moment as the sun set to be with their God. And this is the moment in which Columbus Police Department decided to charge, batons and all. This vision replicated itself across the country throughout the spring. There were seders attacked, stores of kosher and halal food destroyed or thrown out. Religious life in particular eliciting an exacting ire from the state. There was something about the social power of religious life in the liberatory context of these zones that was worth being singled out for attack and elimination. There's something about looking at a crowd of students and community members and children that were standing shoulder to shoulder for prayer that needed the breaking of the batons of the state. It may be helpful to understand this phenomena to give a brief Marxist theory of religion, one that we presented last year, and Jonah argued excellently. And so for those of you who were there last year, I apologize because I am going to quote a little bit at length from the both of us a year ago. So to understand religion, it's helpful to talk a little bit about what ideology is. Ideology is the difference between biological human beings and people, subjects who live in a society. When we say that lived experience matters, or that there's no objective knowledge, that all knowledge is raced and classed and gendered, the more general point that these observations get at is that there's no pre-ideological state of nature that we can retreat to, right? There's no version of being humans, right? Being Marxist that means we shed all ideology and we get to live in the true, clear state of Marxist-Leninism or whatever, right? All life, all social life is ideological life. So this means that when we participate in the institutions that organize our social lives, education and art and sports and media and politics and religion, we're participating in the process that is the creation of ideology and hegemony, the process by which the state manufactures consent. And so the wild thing is that no one has to tell these institutions that govern these things to reproduce capitalist ideology. Class struggle is just so determinant vis-a-vis people's conceptions of their relationship to themselves and the social order and their sense of what is possible and what is right that subjects of capitalist society reproduce state ideology on their own with guidance, prodding, and occasional violent enforcement from the ruling class to keep this process running smoothly. So, does that mean that socialists need to just leave these institutions, stop getting education, stop making art, stop watching the news? No, of course not. We couldn't if we wanted to. But more importantly, these institutions are containers that contain the processes that constitute stress, class struggle, in which the molecular processes that constitute class struggle accumulate. Before, during, and after workers put their hands on the levers of power, workers' movements will be throwing down in civil society, in these ideological institutions, right? When we throw down in our educational systems for better education, right? When we fight for better art, when we fight for news that actually reflects working class movement and working class life, we throw down in civil society, in these ideological institutions, to determine the terrain and the terms of struggle and revolutionary movements. And all of this is also true for our religious life and our religious institutions, right? These are terrains of civil society in which we struggle. And so we established all of that last year to say that you cannot just like throw out religion wholesale, right? It doesn't make any sense to do that. In the same way, you do not throw out education wholesale. This is a terrain of struggle for us. This is a terrain of struggle that we ought to engage in the way we would engage in any other terrain of struggle. And we make assessments in those terrains, right, about what are the correct strategies and tactics, where does it make sense to leverage and where does it not. When we talk about religion, we're talking about an amalgam of practices that are a transhistorical sphere of human activity. You will find human beings engaging in practices to commune with the divine and commune with spirituality well before the advent of capitalism and well after, right? It is a terrain of struggle where we contest for power and articulate the necessity of liberation, and simultaneously where fascists rally and weaponize our human spiritual needs for violence. We see that in the liberated zones that religious life was this key mediator, a key language in which resistance was spoken. And more than that, I would argue that the kinds of religious practice that occurred in the liberated zones transformed them from like just another sit-in, right, to something a little bit more prefigurative. Certainly in taking and creating liberated zones, comrades across the country became responsible for and enmeshed in one another's basic needs and structures of daily living in a way people often do not do with strangers, right? There were medical tents and food tents and bedding and tents and a care for one another's basic needs that often we simply don't get visions into. The social reproduction of life became a communal thing on the lawns and grasses of campuses across the country. But when those needs extended beyond what was strictly necessary, and you begin to hear the call for prayer go up 5 times a day, the food tent stock, not just with halal food for those who keep Zabiha, but as Jonah will say more about, kosher food for an audience who might not have kept kosher for Passover otherwise, something else is occurring. There was something about envisioning the world to come and meeting not just basic needs, but also the spiritual needs, also building the kinds of community that we wish to see in the world to come. Instead of prayer being sequestered in a room somewhere far away, for those of us who have been Muslim students on college campuses, there's like a key you need to get from a guy at a store, and then you like gotta go find the building, and then you find the building, and then the room has 2 locks. Namaz occurs on the lawn, in community, with one another. Seders and Jummah existed all out in the lawns, on campuses that relish a diversity that never interferes with the fundamental white supremacist projects at their core. with Azan on the quads protected by kufiyas and murals honoring the dead and slogans calling for a better future, hijabi students could not be sanitized through their glossy placement on the cover of recruitment brochures. The presence of these students demanded change. The presence of these students demanded change at the core of the project of the university. So it could have been a bare-bones tactical choice to hold space until demands were met, became centers of flourishing student life where assimilation could not take hold. And as religion is a contested terrain of struggle, it was not straightforward. While I argue that religion is transhistorical, and certainly religion and religious life will exist after the revolution as it has for all of human history, that humans will commune with the divine and will crave it always, it is still an ideological sphere in which politics are articulated, and not just by us. And so it should come as no surprise to you that the openings of religious life in liberated zones also came with contestation. At Northwestern, of the days that I was present there, the largest community support rolled through on a Friday afternoon. Whispers rolled throughout the community that there would be a special guest to lead Friday Jummah prayer, and droves of people showed out. People were so excited that there was going to be some special person showing up Friday at Northwestern. And for the first time in a long time as a queer Muslim, I tied my kufiya over my head and got ready to pray. And Omar Suleiman walks out. Now, Omar Suleiman, for those of you who are unaware, was a progressive liberal darling in the Trump years. He was an imam who walked arm in arm with queer clergy at the border, prayed in interfaith delegations for justice, and really stood tall as the face of American Muslims in those Trump-era coalitions where everyone was like really on board with solidarity. And last summer, he was one of the top signatories of the Navigating Differences Statement, a document that stated, Islamic sexual and gender ethics are at odds with certain recently popular societal views and threaten to work with, quote, individuals of all political and religious affiliations to protect the constitutional right of faith communities to live according to their religious convictions, which meant their right to refuse queer people agreement, acceptance, affirmation, promotion, or celebration. In short, he sucks and he's my own personal number one enemy.
That's right.
I really hate the man in like a really personal way, aside from, you know, all of my political disagreements with him. But he is someone who, you know, again, in the Trump years was a progressive and liberal darling, and has moved rapidly, rapidly, rapidly right, particularly on the subjects of gender and sexuality. And so it's important to note here that this was a moment in which, again, huge swaths of the Muslim community came out. Omar Suleiman is also notably Palestinian, right? He has been a loud voice against the genocide in the last 11 months. And notably, that hasn't shifted him at all back towards solidarity. Though he previously marched arm in arm with queer clergy, he has since said that it was a mistake to do so, a mistake to walk arm in arm with the queers, despite the fact that if you go to any Palestine protest in any city, you'll see that, I don't know, not a huge portion of people there are straight. I'm gonna just say it. And yet he has maintained the position that it was wrong to walk arm in arm with the gays. And so Omar Suleiman is one example of the right-wing push in Muslim communities that has made this arena quite contestated. A Muslim nationalism of sorts has also arisen that I would love to talk more about in the discussion, that has made Muslim communities particularly vulnerable to anti-Semitism, to the absolute grifting of people like Jackson Hinkle, who is a MAGA communist, who simply pushes out Nazi nonsense that huge swaths of the Muslim community has become particularly vulnerable to. Which is not to say that any of this is new post October 7th, right? See Andrew Tate. Muslim communities, and again, this religious life in Muslim communities in particular is a contested zone in which fascists have taken huge amounts of power. And so I'd love to talk a little bit more about that in the discussion. So what I'll close with is this, is that religious life played this particular role in convening people with all of their selves, right? To bring to the fore not just demands and bodies, right? But to bring people's whole selves into the movement and to fight for liberation. The powerful role of religious solidarity and spiritual strength in our movements cannot be undersold. The contestation on the terrain of our spirituality and divinity is dire, and the fascists have made their home in our desire for connection with the divine. And they do not own it. It is ours to fight and to win. There's a genocide to stop. There's a world to win. May we, with our bodies, our mouths, our arms, our resources, our divinity, leverage everything we have for Palestine. May we build the world to come. May we win. Inshallah, 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 to revolution we go, comrades.
Hell yeah. Thank y'all for coming out. Very excited to be here with everybody. Mariam gave some notes from this talk that we gave a year ago about religion and the struggle for third spaces. One of the things that we wanted to do with that talk, which I think came out in some of the notes that you shared from that, was trying to push past the sort of fetishistic understanding of religion that exists on the left, and really, actually, multiple fetishistic understandings. You know, an anti-theistic view certainly, but also sort of a religious apologist view that sees it as this inherently that tries to wash over the complex political dynamics within the institutions. Also, a more nuanced view, which says antitheism most of the time, but then sometimes liberation theology happens. Like, we're trying to move past some of these and just really situate religion as a set of motifs, themes, and practices that take place within concrete institutions. And in so doing, we sort of come to see the dynamics of subjugation and liberation, which are expressed through a religious idiom and within religious institutions, as a particular moment of the class struggle writ large. That's to say that, like, from a political perspective, religious institutions and religious ideology are not nearly so unique among the sites of subjectification and social reproduction as they're often treated by social theorists. What I want to do today is use the relative explosion of ritual and religious life that happened in the encampments as sort of a case study in how this works. And I want to do this because I think something really politically significant happened in the encampments, and it happened through the protesters' engagement with ritual and other religious practices. Lots of people and media outlets have commented on the relative religiosity of the encampments, but this has been treated as a sort of decontextualized phenomenon on its own, and I think I see much of what happened religiously in this vein as reflective of longstanding and novel political trajectories. So I'm going to share a few theses about what happened religiously in the encampments, and because this is a case study, I feel justified in focusing what I know best, which is the political dynamics surrounding Jewish religious practice in the encampments. Mariam has already talked about some of the dynamics that came up around Muslim practice, but it's worth saying that even though these two groups played particularly central roles in shaping the culture and political direction of the encampments, lots of other stuff happened religiously in the encampments too, right? I saw, like, there were Buddhist monks in New York leading meditation sits, and there were, like, Anishinaabe elders actually tended a sacred fire at the Toronto encampment. So if people have those kinds of experiences from the encampments, I hope those will come out in discussion too, and we can get a fuller picture of some of all of these things which contributed to this overall atmosphere in the encampments. But the first thesis that I'll start with is that the religious activity of Jewish activists in the encampments represented neither the self-tokenization imagined by the Zionist right nor a pre-existing politico-religious constituency, but the creative construction of a new, authentic Judaism in sort of in real time. And I'll get to why I think this is the case, but first, just to ask how this happened. I think the centering of Palestinian Muslims meant that there existed a certain obvious need for accommodations in the building of these encampments to allow those folks to participate. You know, halal food and accommodations to allow regular prayer, as Mariam talked about. And what I see as a pretty contingent development, either because they're like, happened to be quite a few religious Jews in Columbia University apartheid divest, or because it was Pesach and Jews were feeling more religious or whatever, these same accommodations got extended to Jewish folks. And it feels contingent because overwhelmingly the majority of Jews who were in these encampments did not need these accommodations to justify their presence in the space, right? Overwhelmingly, the Jews who participated in the encampments did not regularly require kosher food, were not themselves regular practitioners of daily prayer, but because the accommodations were made, a lot of Jews took them. I talked to many Jewish activists for whom encampment services were their first experiences with communal prayer since they were kids. Multiple chazanim who led services in some of the encampments that I was participating in did not know how to lead services. They had never done so before, but they were picking up the skill in real time, trying to be a part of this project that their people was engaged in the encampments. And many Jews who were not necessarily keeping kosher for Pesach outside of the encampments were doing so within the encampments because it was actually made a real possibility. I think because the reference point for religious accommodation was Muslim, the accommodations made for Jews were not, at least neither exclusively nor in proportion to the participants, the accommodations appropriate to the level of habitual religious observance of the participants. But the accommodations didn't go unused. Actually, not only did halachically observant Jews who might otherwise have stayed home actually come to the encampments, but in greater numbers, Jewish students found themselves experimenting with new kinds of observance. And so we hosted seders, we hosted Shabbos meals and services, weekday davening, there was a bunch of text study. It was cool, and lots of experiences that people had never participated in before. And I think the thing to say about this is that the encampments brought into being a space within which sort of the prevailing associations of observance with political conservatism, or in the Jewish context, Zionism, were overturned. And as a result, a group of young Jews manifested, however falteringly and for however brief a time, a Judaism with a mix of syncretism, ecumenicalism, traditional engagement, and authenticity, which the preeminent sort of Jewish communal institutions could only dream of. And just to polemicize to the Jews in the room for a second, we see in the creative potential unleashed by the construction of liberated zones the Judaism of the future, I think. Deeply spiritual, deeply engaged with tradition, and unthinkable outside of the space of liberatory struggle which brought it into being. So the second thesis that I'll share about this is that I think the novel Jewish engagement with religious technologies witnessed in the encampments cannot be conceived as a so-called purely theological awakening. This gets back to the framing at the top. But rather represents and reflects the articulation of a Jewish identity politics specific to our current political era, sort of the post-neoliberal era. If you're a leftist who deals much with the questions of anti-Semitism, you know that there is a significant generational gap in both experiences of anti-Semitism and in people's political conclusions from those experiences. That's not to say that anti-Semitism is cyclical or that it didn't exist for a period of time. Actually, I've argued in lots of places, including at this conference before, that the developments in political anti-Semitism following World War II represent a classic case of what Reva Siegel has called preservation through transformation, and that every living generation of Jews has grown up in a country governed by institutions absolutely reliant on political anti-Semitism. Nevertheless, many of the forces of political anti-Semitism obviously have abandoned all pretenses of secularism in the years since Trump's first presidential campaign. And this has produced a call from younger Jews for a renewed struggle for Jewish liberation. Speaking personally, I distinctly remember a conversation with a comrade in 2015 where I said, there's no such thing as structural anti-Semitism, something, something, whatever. And then, fast forward a couple of years, and my daily experience is shaped by pretty regular experiences of anti-Semitic harassment, assault, employment discrimination, and so on. I don't think my experience is uncommon on this point, particularly for young Jews who are sort of religiously engaged and visible as such. I think a lot of young Jews are coming up at a time when their classmates and coworkers are being radicalized by the alt-right, and that has produced a sort of an interest in waging anti-fascist fights for Jewish liberation. And so, just as with the last wave of left-wing Jewish identitarianism during the 1960s, a lot of this interest in articulating a Jewish political subjectivity has engaged Jewish religion as a mechanism for the building of more durable identities. For better or worse, the political conditions which gave birth to Jewish secularism are gone, and it seems to me an empirical reality that Jews seeking to build a Jewish identity politics have sort of had no choice but to do so through religion. Many examples of this, there's the halachic left sort of organizing milieu, the movement of independent minyanim and shuls around the country. We can see it here. This is my 8th socialism conference. I have never seen so many yarmulkes at a socialism conference. And so given this context, it seems clear to me that the sudden surge of interest in Jewish religious practice in the encampments was born not just of sort of an abstract interest in spirituality, but in being Jewish. Jewish participants took the accommodations offered to them because they valued the fact of their offering. They wanted their Jewishness to be politically meaningful, not just in the sense of guilty allyship, but out of a recognition of their freedom struggle as a part of a struggle for collective liberation. And I think it worked. My comrade Hadass, an Israeli-born Jew living in New York, said of her time at the Columbia University encampment, "I have never experienced the level of solidarity and the depth of understanding about anti-Semitism that I am seeing across college campuses right now. Until the recent phase of the new movement for Palestine emerged on American campuses last fall, I had never before witnessed such a deliberate commitment to learning about and confronting anti-Semitism head-on." This spirit extended throughout the encampments. Many encampments held workshops and teach-ins educating protesters about anti-Semitism and the Jewish fight for liberation. Protesters made keffiyeh walls to safeguard the privacy of their Muslim and Jewish comrades in prayer. At UChicago, we told them to stop because our services are a lot longer. It was hard. And SJPs across the country, but particularly at Columbia, took a vocal stand against anti-Semitism as part of the fundamental, oft-repeated politics of the movement. It was a common refrain. Columbia University's violent attacks on the encampments were attacks not just on Palestinian students, but on Palestinian, Muslim, Jewish students, students of color. Jews were a part of the movement's vision of collective liberation. No doubt, this embrace of sort of Jewish liberation by the encampments carried a cost. In LA, neo-Nazis, Proud Boys, and other fascists joined forces with the Kahanists to crack skulls and attack Jewish protesters. One yelled, according to Robin D.G. Kelly, "We're here to finish what Hitler started." Mm-hmm. At Columbia and George Washington University, Jewish Voice for Peace chapters were disbanded, or were dechartered by the university, effectively ending university-sanctioned Jewish life for non-Zionist students on campus. And as Marian pointed out, visible Jewish participation in the encampments also meant that Jews also saw our services and rituals broken up by the police. We should think about this. People who are thinking about anti-Semitism in the country should think about the images of cops busting up a Seder in New York. Nevertheless, I think these anti-Semitic attacks are coming one way or the other. And they're being fueled by alliances between the state and far-right Zionists. In the UK, in light of the so-called anti-Semitism crisis in the Labour Party, Jews are 6 times more likely to be investigated for anti-Semitism than non-Jews, and are 13 times more likely to be expelled from the party. As of January of this year, more than one-third of the people arrested under Germany's laws criminalizing hateful symbols, including the swastika, had been Jews protesting against the genocide. And Jews make up about 0.15% of the German population. So in this transnational context in which the anti-Semitism of the Christian state is expressing itself through Zionist policing, it's critical that Jewish enemies of that state forge new and deeper linkages of solidarity with other communities resisting oppression. And in the encampments, we saw what that can look like. Jewish students in large numbers making sacrifices to join our comrades in struggle and seeing our struggles uplifted in turn. In the final instance, I think we ought to see this wave of Jewish interest in religion in the encampments as a popular Jewish revolt. The flourishing of Jewish ritual was politically meaningful because every force of reaction in white supremacy has aligned to make these practices out of reach to Jews like me and the people in those encampments, and still we're refusing to be stripped of our Jewishness. From our own communities, we're being run out. Scores of Jewish professionals have been fired since the start of the genocide for expressing support for Palestine. Hundreds of congregants have been banned from their shuls. I know of multiple minyanim, which have been founded basically because the entire minyan got kicked out of their old synagogue and is trespassed from the building and they need a place to pray. Just recently, Hillel announced a partnership with the Secure Communities Network to keep Jewish students safe from pro-Palestine protests on campus. So clearly, Jews, like the folks in this room, are just simply not a part of their picture of what Jewish safety looks like. And of course, from the right, including some reactionaries who happen to hold an anti-Zionist politic, were being shot at, stabbed, beaten, threatened with bombs, and otherwise attacked for going to shul or wearing a tichel. Some of my Jewish comrades have no doubt distanced themselves from their Jewish identity since October, but some have resisted this twin carrot and stick sort of pressure towards assimilation and sought out a Jewish identity politics which feels authentic and liberatory. And that is what feels politically exciting about Jewish religious practice taking such a prominent place in the encampments. It represents a Jewish revolt against both the anti-Semitic right and the pressures of a white supremacist ruling class project looking to conscript our bodies at the expense of our Jewish sort of neshamas. It should be seen as a radical act, even, you know, notwithstanding the complexities of diving back into a tradition with all the sort of heteropatriarchal muck of ages. I have one more thesis to share. I'm pretty much out of time. I'll say very quickly, I hope it's like just to return to the framing and to make some of this analysis hopefully accessible to people with those different experiences in the conversation. I hope it's clear, like, this is what it means, that religion is not some like unique metaphysical standalone phenomenon that acts upon history, but rather is a vehicle through which history moves. A political constituency responding to their own radicalization at the hands of their oppressors was in search of ways to articulate sort of a defiant affirmation of their own identities and found literal rituals through which to do so. I think there are many such cases, queer Muslims, anti-fascist pagans, a small minority, but they exist, of anti-Hindutva Hindus on the left. There's a whole debate among people raised Hindu about this question, but... So I'll jump to the third thesis, which is that a significant factor in the power and authenticity of this sort of encampment Judaism was its largely grassroots, non-clerical character, and relatedly, the militancy of its practitioners. So I don't think this will be particularly controversial for me to point out that even though we acknowledge sort of the liberatory potentials which exist in religious institutions and communities, usually that potential is undermined by sort of the constraints on the community placed by sort of a conservative institutional apparatus, which is well suited for counterinsurgency. It has, you know, many dimensions, ideological, legal, class dimensions. You know, we can think about the ways in which the economies of religious communities tend to work, relying on wealthy donors, relying on remaining a certain kind of institution, and even for their political advocacy, relying on the perception that they are sort of these broad, you know, they're these like broad institutions that speak for everybody. You know, so notwithstanding the important base-building role played by certain imams and Muslim institutions in the Palestine solidarity struggle, the important role played in breaking through the hegemonic philo-Semitic Zionism played by rabbis and various Jewish nonprofits, I think we have to admit that at the highest points of militancy, these forces have overwhelmingly exerted a conservatizing influence and can impart this is because this is how they do politics, right? This is how they remain effective as sort of their political project. And so I want to suggest that the radicalism of the movement in which these new experiments in Jewish identity and religious practice took place was actually indispensable to the organic authenticity of the experiment's results. This is why the institutions can't replicate this thing. You don't get this transformative liberatory Judaism by operating within the parameters of liberal universalism. You get it in the context of a heated struggle with the state, a real confrontation with power. And so I think we need to continue building containers for the furthering of this work, which remain independent of the network of mostly liberal white supremacist institutions which govern the rest of Jewish life. Our liberation theologies do not produce radical action. They're sustained by it. And so, God willing, we should see more of these experiments in lay-led, radically ecumenical Jewish practice. And if we share this goal, then I think we have to keep alive the moment of militant confrontation with power which birthed them. The future of radical Judaism, of queer Islam, and the future of so many liberatory traditions emerging throughout our movement right now relies on the continuation of this moment. The next step in their development is not a retreat to the institutions, it's the opposite. I think it lives and dies with the movement. So let this continue to be the Judaism of the barricades. Let's build our traditions to give us strength to fight off riot cops with nothing but each other and an empty water jug. And for the sake of the traditions, but for the sake of so much more, let's continue to escalate. Let's continue to antagonize the state and find life and spirituality not in the comfort of suburban shuls and masjids, but around the fires of burning police precincts. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.